Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's presentation. My name's, for those who don't know me, I'm Michael McKellar, the President of the Victorian, Australian Institute of International Affairs, Victoria. And it really is a pleasure to see you here tonight. We've also got some distinguished members and visitors here. We've got His Excellency, Mr. Anton Babich, the Croatian Consul, and we've got Lois Appleby, who was representing Canada in Australia, but then went back to Canada, and I think they've chosen somebody else, haven't they, Lois? She actually, I've got to tell you this, she actually ran the Paralympic Games in Sydney in 2000 and ran the council like a watch. It was very, very good indeed. And we've got a whole lot of new members and visitors, so thank you all very much indeed for coming along, because we're going to hear a very interesting speech tonight from a very interesting man. Australia's struggle for security. We've got Mr. Cameron Stewart, the Associate Editor of The Australian. Now, you may have noticed in recent times that The Australian and its derivatives have been featuring a little bit in the news, and I said to Cameron, have you been busy today? And he said, yes, he had. Whether he wants to mention anything about those sorts of issues or not, I don't know, because they do pertain to international affairs just a little bit. But he wasn't writing about security, and he's going to tell us about security tonight, because we're all aware that China is undergoing a massive growth phase, and there is quite a lot of concern amongst a number of countries about the rise of power, the Chinese power, in our region. Not so much to us, perhaps, but to some of the near neighbours, they would be very aware of what is going on. One of the issues that they are pretty good at is building submarines, which we're not so good at this stage. And Cameron actually is the guy that broke the story about how we were not doing terribly well in with Australia, that Australia's largest defence project, the $8 billion plan to build three new air warfare destroyers, was already 2 years late, barely a year after the constructions of the ship had begun. Now, Cameron Stewart, as well as being Associate Editor of The Australian, has been an intelligence officer with the Defence Signals Directorate. He's written on issues of defence, security, terrorism and international relations over two decades. He has won many awards for his work, and in 2008 was named the Graham Perkin Australian Journalist of the Year. And that is not a compliment or an award that is made lightly. It really is a very major award, probably the best you can get. So to fill us in on how we're going to deal with the emerging issues relating to defence in our region, would you please join me in welcoming Mr. Cameron Stewart?
Thanks very much. I'd really just like to say, first of all, these days in newspapers, times are pretty tough, so we've been doing a lot of multi-skilling, and so today I've spent the whole day writing about Christine Nixon. So I can answer any question you want on Christine Nixon, okay? But apologies, because I haven't clicked my mind into defence properly, so I'll try and do that right now. It's a very broad topic, this, and so I really wanted to just throw out a few things to all of you, a few ideas, hopefully a few provocative ideas, and I'd love you to come back at me about some of these issues. So that's probably the best way to do it. So I'd chat for a little while, and then please come back at me. I'm happy to talk about absolutely anything, including the latest things that have been happening. I just want to thank you very much for coming to listen to a News Limited journalist, you know, at this point in time. I want to assure... Can you hear that okay, by the way? Okay. I want to make it clear that I've never hacked a phone. I've never hired a private eye. I've never worked for the News of the World. I did many years ago, as you mentioned, work from an intelligence agency called the Defence Signals Directorate, and they may or may not have used interesting means to obtain their information. And I'd happily tell you about it, but I would have to actually kill you, I think. So instead, I'll begin on far safer ground and just talk a little bit about some of the security challenges which I see from my perspective on The Australian, which covers security in a hopefully a fairly serious manner. some of the issues facing Australia, I'd like to hark back to the 1990s when I was the Foreign Affairs and Defence Writer for the Australian in the Canberra Press Gallery. Now, in those days, politicians weren't so media trained, and occasionally you'd get a front row seat to a politician who literally lost it. And I would speak of Gareth Evans, who I had to deal with quite a lot, who was spectacular with his temper and used to throw ashtrays across his office when he got mad. Paul Keating, of course, was legendary. You'd see journalists who got the call from him literally holding the phone out like that and just sweat running off their brow. But these days, I think, sadly, our current breed of politicians are much more controlled, measured, some might even say a bit bland. But in February this year, behind closed doors in Canberra, the Defence Minister, Stephen Smith, had what I would call his Gareth Evans ashtray moment. He was told by the Navy that the big supply ship, the HMAS Tobruk, Australia's only got a few of them, which had been promised by the Navy to be ready to help out in the recovery efforts in Cyclone Yasi, could not be made available. The other two ships, Canimbla and Manura, were also unavailable. And it was, as you might recall, a revelation which made even ordinary Australians who rarely took an interest in defence and security issues shake their heads in amazement. How, they asked, with more than $25 billion of our taxpayers' money pumped into defence each year, could we not have a single suitable Navy ship to help in such a disaster? This wasn't Sumatra, it wasn't the Solomons, it wasn't anywhere that was difficult to get to. It was Queensland. Since that moment, I'd like to say that Stephen Smith's lot has improved, but it really hasn't, because since then we've had the Skype sex scandal. We've had, very sadly, a death in Afghanistan, probably Australian death in Afghanistan, probably every 3 weeks on average. We've also had the revelation that the nation's largest defence project, the building of the three air warfare destroyers, some of it here in Melbourne also, was up to 2 years behind schedule because of faulty shipbuilding here in the Melbourne shipyard in Williamtown. We also had a few days which weren't well publicised by the Navy, but actually true, when not a single one of our six submarines could be put to sea. Now, look, if I were being charitable, we might be able to pass this off as a series of bad events as bad luck. We may even be able to say in the scheme of things it doesn't really matter, because apart from our limited but difficult involvement in Afghanistan, Australia is a country at peace with no immediate security concerns. But is this really the case? Is this really bad luck, or is there a deeper malaise affecting Australia's defence and security policy? Tonight I want to just outline briefly what I think are Australia's genuine security concerns, and by these I mean both externally and internally. I'd like to point out why I think we've reached this point and what should be done, and I'd very much welcome your questions and feedback at the end of this, because if there's one thing Australia doesn't have, it's enough informed debate on defence and security issues. We have a very small cabal of defence experts, mostly academics or ex-soldiers, who lecture to a largely uninformed Australian public about these issues. And yet, poor defence decisions cost you, I, and everybody out there a massive amount of money. For every pink bat scandal, you could have 30 of those for every one bad defence decision. And that's an issue which is not really well recognised, I think, out there in the community. I want to first have a bit of a chat about how I see the state of Australia's external defence challenges. Now, the most obvious starting point, I guess, is our involvement in Afghanistan and the related problem of Pakistan. But I'm not really sure that this is what dominates attention in Canberra these days. Yes, the government wants to keep our troops there till 2014. And yes, it has public opinion against the war. But barring a terrible mass casualty event, I don't see the government withdrawing our troops significantly earlier than this. I'll come back to this later, because I think actually the strategic question, which is causing much more intrigue these days with the government, is the issue of China and the US. Are we witnessing a slow tectonic shift in the power structure in the Pacific, a shift which could have massive implications for our security? The debate, as you would know, has been lively. Some, like Paul Dibb, see China's rise as a military power as being overstated. He argues it's many years, if not decades, away from inquiring the serious sorts of long-range military capabilities to seriously challenge the balance of power in the Pacific and potentially threaten a country like Australia. Yet, in the same breath, you have others such as Ross Babbage of the Kokoda Foundation arguing that China is much more of a here and now proposition and that it has a military budget, the desire, and very soon the hardware to cause genuine concern in the region about its intentions and its abilities. And then there is the United States. There's a perception in many quarters that the US is in a phase of strategic retreat in the Pacific. Its debt crisis, which has been extraordinary in the last couple of days to see unfold, means it will have to cut its defence budget to some degree. And so the argument goes that inevitably they will have less of a presence in the Pacific. Now, I think that there's no doubt the US is in a phase of strategic retreat. Obama must cut the debt. The military is already taking a haircut as a result. And Americans, I think, are tired of war after Iraq, after Afghanistan. We saw a similar mood of retreat, you might recall, after Vietnam under Jimmy Carter, and after Rwanda, after Somalia, actually, rather than Rwanda, with Bill Clinton. Now, whether this translates into any sizable and lasting cuts to the US presence in the Pacific at a time of a rising China, though, I think is more doubtful. I think that the US is seized on the issue of China and that this will be to Australia's lasting strategic benefit. Again, more of this later. So I don't really think you're going to see a US drawdown in the Pacific in the way that many people are saying, despite the fact that I think the US is in a stage of strategic retreat. I don't think that's an inconsistent position, and I think that's what we'll see unfold. Arguably, the most significant defence debate in recent Australian history took place behind closed doors again in Canberra in late 2008 and early 2009. It was a debate between the Hawks and the Doves about China's military intentions and what it meant for Australia. Now, this was a debate which the government didn't want to see aired, but the Australian actually aired it. It was a very heavy time, I recall, being a journalist involved in it, because it wasn't something they wanted to see out in the public. But what we saw was on the side of the Doves were the Australian intelligence agencies, notably the Defence Intelligence Organisation and the Office of National Assessments. They argued that China's military spending was largely defensive, was aimed at safeguarding its territorial waters and boosting self-esteem rather than actual power projection. But a powerful group inside defence argued differently. China, they said, was a power that needed combating, and it needed Australia's defence strategy to be directed almost entirely towards that aim. Both groups tried to win the ear of the then Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, who was not shy about his own views on China. He came down decisively, though, on the side of the Hawks. So in 2009, the Defence White Paper was born. This is a blueprint that promised the largest expansion of naval power since World War II, but it didn't name China as the inspiration behind it. The shopping list in this white paper was remarkable. It included 12 new submarines, doubling the current Collins-class fleet, 3 new air warfare destroyers, and easily the most capable and complex Navy warships Australia has seen. These were to provide protection for an expeditionary force, something Australian Navy hadn't had before. It was a quantum leap. It also promised more capable frigates, patrol boats, and the list goes on. Along with the promises of 100 joint strike fighters, a larger and hardened army, the White Paper promised to entrench Australia as one of the world's most muscular middle powers. The problem, though, was that it committed Australia to $130 billion worth of military expansion without, in my opinion, properly considering the ability of politics, the defence bureaucracy, or Australian defence industry to deliver its dreams. Barely 2 years on, it's my contention that the Australian Defence White Paper is dead in the water. It has sadly been let down by hubris, by politics, and by reality. Let me explain. If I asked any of you here tonight what the most memorable promise of the White Paper was, I suspect you'd say it was the promise to build 12 new submarines in Australia. This project is estimated by ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, to cost about $36 billion. That's easily the largest single government project since Federation. Now, it remains a mystery as to how the number 12 was chosen. I know it wasn't chosen on a detailed strategic assessment, and rumours persist that the then Prime Minister was the person who plucked that figure. out of the blue. Now, I don't know whether that's the case or not, but what the white paper did do was it called on these submarines to have a range and weaponry which no existing conventional submarine has. In other words, it committed Australia to building a largely homemade submarine, a son of the Collins class, if you like, except twice as many of them. Now, you might not believe this coming from a journalist, but I've tried very hard to like the Collins class submarines. I'm a firm believer in the need for Australia to have submarines. I've even sailed on one of them, the HMAS Deschano, and have unfortunately been on it during an emergency where I thought briefly I'd sink to the bottom of the Indian Ocean. But I still thought that the whole concept was a great idea, and when they work, they're a very fine submarine. But I believe they have been a strategic failure for Australia, not because they were late, too noisy and enormously over budget, but simply because Defence has been unable to keep them in the water often enough to credibly describe the submarines as a fleet. They've been plagued throughout their lives with far greater technical problems than anyone expected, with their diesel motors, their combat systems, their software, hoses, etc. They're in dry dock more than they're in the water. About 2 months ago, for the first time, we actually had not a single seaworthy submarine. And for much of the recent past, we've only had one out of six ready for action. That's not a media beat-up, it's a fact. And the fact is that it'll only get worse from here on in. Angus Houston told a recent Defence Estimates hearing that Collins would only get less reliable as they get older. So we're about to see a long, slow decline from an already low base. So what does the government do? It promises that after struggling to build six submarines, then largely failing to maintain them, we'll build 12 homegrown submarines, even more complex than the Collins-class boats, and miraculously, this time, it will work. Recently, we've seen some commentators challenge some of the government's assumptions about this project. They say that Australia should consider buying submarines largely off the shelf from other countries, proven ones, most likely from the Europeans. They say that even though these submarines would be smaller and a shorter range than the Collins, they could be purchased quite literally for one-third of the price than a largely homemade submarine with only a fraction of the technical risk, including to taxpayers. Proponents of this idea argue that their cheap price tag means Australia could actually purchase 12 submarines, and with the use of forward bases such as Guam or Singapore, their strategic reach would still be substantial. Others, such as my own colleague Greg Sheridan, actually thinks we should go for nuclear subs. But so far, the advocates of these off-the-shelf submarine programs have received little support from either the Navy or the government. The Navy argues Australia's unique geographic and strategic circumstances means it needs a longer-range submarine to conduct long-range patrols in the Northern Hemisphere. The Navy also prefers the more fancy bells and whistles which a more expensive homegrown submarine would have. The government's been careful not to say much about it, about precisely what sort of submarine it wants, except to say that it will be built in Adelaide. They've still left the door open to purchase a largely off-the-shelf submarine and build it in Australia. But the government has been slow to move, and in the 2 years since the white paper was delivered, there's been almost no progress towards this, the biggest project in Australia's history. The government is giving every indication of being paralysed with indecision. It's caught between its natural desire to make the submarines into a historic nation-building program, creating thousands of jobs, fostering technical and shipbuilding know-how, and shoring up some valuable marginal seats in the process. Yet it knows that that neither the government nor Australia can deliver, can afford the likely cost blowouts and delays, which history tells us are almost certainly going to haunt such a massive and ambitious project. And this, at its heart, is where I think the Gillard government is. It's caught between no man's land on the fundamental issue of defence procurement, the single issue which has caused so much grief and bad defence headlines in recent years. Barely a week goes by where we don't hear of a costly setback for warships or submarines or planes or helicopters or missiles or tankers. The list goes on. Defence Material Organisation, which manages more than 200 defence projects, is currently 30% behind schedule on average. So at a time of limited funds, there's an enormous temptation to buy ready-made weaponry off the shelf from other countries, letting them wear the substantial costs of research and development. In recent years, Australia's purchased a fleet of Super Hornet fighters, C-17 transport planes and Abraham tanks from the US. Each of these has arrived on time, on budget, with a minimum of fuss. Increasingly, the government is looking to purchase off-the-shelf requirements in relation to Air Force and Army, but with Navy, it still favours a homegrown shipbuilding industry. It argues, with some merit, that it's strategically crucial for Australia to be able to independently maintain its naval fleets in a time of war as an island nation. And yet the flagship project for Australia's national shipbuilding currently is the Zero Warfare Destroyer project, the one I mentioned before. $8 billion to construct three new air warfare destroyers. But this project is now well behind schedule. It's over budget after barely a year of construction. The reasons is a combination of poor shipbuilding skills, poor project management, and poor oversight from defence. In short, Australia has lost the naval shipbuilding capability it enjoyed during the 1990s when we built 10 Anzac frigates here in Melbourne, plus the Collins-class submarines and the Huon mine hunters. In a country like Australia, it comes down to an economy of scale question with these massive projects. There's not enough naval work to guarantee continuous, efficient shipyards in this country. And so what happens is after a big project goes, the experts and the technical experts that are required to build it leave the Navy and they go to mining. They go to West Australia, get serious money, and why would they come back? And by the time the next big project comes around, because Australia has only X amount of Navy ships, basically the problem is that they're not there again. This is what happened with the warfare destroyers here in Melbourne. They had the experts from the Anzac project, built them well, and then there was a big delay. They vanished, and the company BAE really struggled to actually find people here, and it's a real problem, and it's a fundamental issue for the government in deciding which way to go here. Because, I mean, does it keep risking billions of dollars to subsidise a small defence industry for the sake of nation building, because that's what a lot of this stuff really is? Or does it conclude that the rest of the world can do defence projects better and more cheaply, meaning Australia will have a greater defence capability and less cost to the taxpayer? And I think that's a debate which the government is really unresolved on, and that's why you're seeing mixed messages coming from Stephen Smith, who says, oh, we're going to support Adelaide, we're going to build all these ships here, it's going to be great for industry. And yet they get the really nasty headlines, which basically say, look, billions of dollars lost. So it's a classic trap for them. And look, speaking of costs to the taxpayer, the extravagant promises in the Defence White Paper were predicated on the government lifting defence spending in real terms by at least 3% for the foreseeable future. Yet only 2 years after the White Paper was released, the Labor government has reneged on this, cutting some $4 billion out of the last defence budget. In some ways, defence has brought this on itself by failing to spend its allocated budget over the last 12 months, making it ripe for the picking by a Treasury which is keen to get back into the black. But sadly, these budget cuts make it highly unlikely that the aims of this White Paper will ever be released. It's a familiar story. You might remember the seminal 1987 White Paper by Paul Dibb, which enshrined the defence of Australian mainland as the prime focus of our defence force, promised a massive expansion of the Navy and Air Force. Well, that White Paper was predicated on a defence budget of 3% of GDP. It never happened, not even close. Even now, after a commendable effort by the Howard government to boost defence spending in real terms for the first time in a generation, it currently sits at 1.8% of GDP, less than the minimum target of countries in NATO. So what needs to be done? Well, so far, the government's strategy seems to be recovery by review. There's a topic in defence, from sex to submarines to supply ships, which is basically whatever you can think of, there is a review into it. I think that it's not a particularly healthy state of affairs at the moment. I think that there's lots of decisions where the government is just cannot really finalise its position. It's caught between a tight budget and it's the distortion between what it can afford and what it wants is really a serious problem for the government, and I think they're going to have to scale back to a large degree. Rather than suggest more reviews, I'd like to throw out a couple of ideas to you, and I'd welcome your feedback on them. These are some steps which I think the government could do in order to give us a bit more confidence in our security. Firstly, I think it needs to swallow its pride and after the next election, whichever government it is, release a new, more modest white paper based not on dreams but on what the reality is of what we can achieve politically and what Australian industry can deliver for taxpayers. This would include, sadly but true, I think fewer submarines, fewer joint strike fighters, perhaps a larger SAS, rather than have the SAS get completely exhausted, being the only frontline forces that actually see combat in Australia. A realignment, if you like, of aims and means. Clearly, the Navy needs serious love and attention. I think we need to up the pay scales of sailors, especially technical specialists, to steal them back from the mining community. These people are sadly lacking on our ships. We need to institute major reform so that the maintenance and management of our fleet is improved, so that the Cyclone Yasi incident is never repeated. To be fair, the government is taking steps in this direction. I also think we need to buy our future weaponry, ready-made off the shelf whenever we reasonably can, and where we do not, for example, perhaps with major shipbuilding projects in Australia, we need to source as much as we can from overseas to minimise the risk of budget and schedule blowouts and a poorer defence capability. And lastly, but perhaps most controversially, I think the time is right to take a historic step in Australia's defence by welcoming American forces to share to a larger degree our defence bases in Northern Australia. As I've outlined tonight, Australia's defence and security policies are under severe strain. The US is also under pressure to draw down its substantial presence in the Pacific. I'm wondering, and I'd be interested in your views on this, whether Australians have moved beyond their reflexive opposition to US troops being based to some degree here in Australia. Former Defence Secretary Ian Smith is currently heading a review into bases in Northern Australia with a view to increasing the military presence in those regions. I think that there are moves afoot to increase American presence up in those bases, and I think it's an opportune time in our history to invite them in to some degree and give them a greater investment in our security at relatively little cost to us. I wouldn't be surprised if we hear an announcement to this effect coming up. It would be a rare piece of good news in what's been an otherwise fairly dismal and challenging few years for Australia's security and defence policy. Before I just ask you for questions you have, I just wanted to discuss quickly another issue which I think would be good news for Australia if it took the step, and that it would be for Australia to actually withdraw its troops from Afghanistan as early as reasonably possible. Now, I don't agree with the editorial line that my paper takes on this. We all have different views within the paper. But the papers are very much of the opinion that Australian troops should stay there till right through to 2014. I think personally that the conflict has passed its use-by date politically, strategically, and perhaps even morally. Most Australians don't support our continued involvement in the conflict because they see no clear into it and no concrete results. I think the government's locked itself into staying until 2014, almost exclusively on the grounds that it does not want to be seen to be walking away from the conflict before the US does. I think it's an alliance judgment. But I think the fundamental rationale which led Australia to the conflict, the notion that if we don't tackle terrorism in Afghanistan, it will come back to haunt us in Bali and elsewhere, is no longer a sustainable argument. It's certainly no longer a provable argument. I think there's a very good argument that Afghanistan in the future will be a war which depends on specialised US forces, drones and intelligence, rather than on-the-ground troops. And in my opinion, the sooner that we move to that phase, the better it will be. Look, there's lots of other issues I haven't discussed here tonight, such as perhaps Australia's future Air Force, even given the problems with the massive Joint Strike Fighter project, the politics in America. Also, the social experiment of women in frontline combat with the Australian Defence Force, and of course the terrible and endless sexual scandals that seem to haunt the ADF and the culture that surrounds that. Also, I haven't talked about the problems which journalists face in investigating defence and security issues because of the Orwellian attitude, I would call it, of defence towards releasing even the most basic forms of information. It makes it very, very hard to scrutinise. In my 20 years of journalism, it's never been harder today to find out the truth of what actually happens with these major decisions. You are stopped at every single step of the way. And if you get a reasonably good story, a good example might be the recent story which the Australian wrote on the air warfare destroyers, revealing the big blowout there. The moment that happens, then there's investigations, they check telephone numbers. It's a very ugly process, and so it's much harder for journalists to complain, but it really is much harder for journalists to expose some of these decisions and hold people to account for their mistakes in areas like defence, and I think that's personally a real issue. Look, I'd like to thank you all for listening to my sort of rant across a whole range of areas tonight. I really appreciate you coming because it really is people like you who make the effort to engage in these issues, who contribute to the debate that we have in Australia about this, and I think it's incredibly healthy. And the reason why I'm just stopping here is because it is such a broad topic. There's a whole lot of things I've touched on. There may be other things you want to raise, and it can be anything from anything you want. So I'll just throw open the floor, and please chat away.
Now, there's an open-ended invitation if ever I heard one. Who would like to start the question? All over the place. That's really good. We'll start down the back.
Michael Swigger, there were two points that you dropped in I'd like you to pick up on. One was Greg Sheridan's comment about nuclear suffering. Bearing in mind the nation-building aspect, that we maintain critical mass in New South Wales and quite a few other things, that seemed to me to be a rather interesting strategy, perhaps purchase the nuclear submarines and there's quite an interesting train that follows that. The train also follows an assessment of the effectiveness or otherwise of manned aircraft. Given the development cycles and delivery cycles, the questions being raised less and less privately, you may have seen the last generation of advanced strike fighters. Consequently, the loss of long-range missile capacity, the Brits have, and UAVs, which the Defence Force is indeed developing, seems to me to be part of a more visionary way of dealing with it. We certainly haven't got a tremendous package at the moment. We're going to have to reinvest across a very broad span, and that's very, very clear. In order to get good morale, good investment, and good leverage, I'm just suggesting if you put those three elements together, you might have something that would both invigorate and produce some
I think you make some good points there. The nuclear submarine option is one of those really interesting topics because it's one of those no-go zones in Canberra. Honestly, you walk into the Defence Minister's office and you start talking to advisors about this sort of stuff and they'll just give you blank stares. They just feel it's not a politically saleable option, and I think that is absolutely wrong not to consider it as an option. I'm not saying you necessarily choose it, but their argument is that Australia doesn't have a nuclear power industry, therefore it's much harder to maintain these things here. It costs a lot. The upfront costs are therefore going to be very substantial, and they just don't like the politics of it. That's the truth of it, Mark. So they really don't like the concept. They think it's almost unsellable to the population. Yet I would argue if you took the politics out of it, which of course is a naive way to approach it, but if you did take the politics out of it, You have a reasonable concept there. You have nuclear submarines go a long way. They don't have to pop up to the surface to breathe all the time. They can for a country like Australia, it would be a superb asset. And the thing is, you get them off the Americans relatively cheaply. They bear the costs of fixing them, of doing a whole lot of stuff there. It's not such a bad concept, but it is politically unsalable at the moment. And I think that's wrong. I think it should be part of the debate because half the problem on these issues, as I said before, there just isn't a debate. Now, on the UAVs, it's interesting. Again, you've got a bit of politics there. Like, basically, the Joint Strike Fighters, you know, considered to be what they call a fifth-generation fighter, so it's the most advanced of anything they're building at the moment. And so I think Australia just thinks it's the best thing to do. It's too early, really, to not purchase or not pretend you're going to purchase these things. I think this unmanned aircraft are an incredible possibility, and they probably will end up replacing these things eventually. But I think at this point in time, any country that's serious about its defence cannot just walk away from manned fighter jets. I think that's a long way off in the future.
Young man,
I had a question about. Sorry, I'm Daniel. I'm a member here at the Institute, a student at the Uni. A question about two projects. One was. Maybe if you explain a little, it's not only in Australia, I've noted from my reading, it's around the world, this sudden obsession with these individual air warfare destroyers as opposed to multi-purpose I suppose, traditional shifts. And the other one was your personal opinion on the decision to go with the Joint Strike Fighter as opposed to the Raptor, if America was willing, or the Eurofighter. I know it was a big debate a while ago, and there was lots of comparing them. I was just wondering on your own personal view on if the Joint Strike Fighter was the way to go.
Well, on the destroyer issue, the Howard government decided it wanted to have a boat that could actually help protect troops when they sent it out. So if Australia had a big peacekeeping mission, or not peacekeeping really, but a big sort of some military expedition where they wanted to send 1,000 or so troops, air warfare destroyers could actually protect it. They've got this incredible radar bubble that basically can fend off a lot of attacks. So that's what they wanted to have. Now, the question, of course, is what was the strategic analysis behind that? Because really, it's very hard to conceive Australia being in that position without having the American forces right next to us. And so I think that was a very, very brave, I say brave, I don't actually agree with the decision particularly, but it was a very bold decision by the government, because I don't really see where that strategic situation would happen where those ships are needed, but certainly they wanted them, and that was the thinking at the time. That's why they chose the air warfare destroyer. Now, the Joint Strike Fighter was an almost comical decision, the way this happened. I mean, if ever you want a textbook case of really bad process on a really massive decision that affects Australians, the Joint Strike Fighter is a textbook case. They basically made a big fuss about buying a new fighter for Australia. They got the teams of Air Force blokes out there, and they said, OK, we're going to listen to anyone and everyone. So the blokes, the French blokes, came in with their little gold fighter pins and took them out to free dinners, and the Germans came and the Russians. I mean, didn't the Russians try to sell us their planes? I mean, it was extraordinary. They all came in. It was this big process, and defence said, yes, it's all going to be fine. And then Lockheed Martin flew a couple of blokes to Fort Worth in Texas. They fell under their spell, and before you know it, the whole process was abandoned. It was an extraordinary situation. Now, it's not to say that history won't prove them right, but it was a truly amateur hour on the part of the Defence Force. And I went over to Texas and talked to all the people who were involved and tried to reconstruct the story, and it was quite frightening. And so it was chosen on a very bad basis. It was chosen on a wing and a prayer, quite literally. And to a degree, it still is, although I think eventually it'll come out, like most of these big fighter projects, like the F-111 and all that, it'll come out billions of dollars over budget, very, very late. But, you know, in the end, it might actually be a half-decent plane. I hope it is, and I suspect it will be.
Tim?
Yes, thank you very much. Tim Healy from the Institute. I think that you've raised so many issues, but I'll just make one observation on the question. On the air warfare destroyers, to the right term?
Yes.
These are, I understand, Spanish vessels. They are in service with other navies. I think the Norwegians have them. I just find it almost incomprehensible that we can't actually build even them. It's only the hull so far that's causing the problem. That's an observation that you probably answered that. They're already in service and have been for several years.
That's a very good observation. And in fact, what's really intriguing when you think about this is Australia could have bought these boats completely built by the Spanish. The Spanish have built them. They've done all the mistakes. They've made these ships. We could have just said, you know what, sail your Spanish AWDs to Australia, please. And well, the problem here is that the Navy said, this is Australia, we need a lot more bells and whistles. And so they put a whole bunch of bells and whistles on, and the Australian government decided they should be built here because that's a nation-building project. And so all of a sudden, you inject all this risk into these things, and that's precisely what's happened. And it's not all for bad things. I mean, I sound like I'm very much against this nation-building concept. I mean, you know, you foster jobs, you foster technological know-how, you foster a lot of stuff that's really good for Australia. But by gee, you take a risk. And that's a perfect case where I think they could have just bought them straight off the shelves and literally sailed them into the harbour.
Right. Now, if I'm going to have my question now.
Pushing it now.
Sorry?
Go, Hilo.
You hardly mentioned the Army. You mentioned maybe increasing the size of the SAS. It strikes me, considering what we attempt to do internationally in so many theatres almost at the same time, we have a very, very small army, and I don't know how many active troops we have, but only a few thousand, I would thought, 5,000 or 6,000. It seems to me that we're very vulnerable and we're very under-resourced in the army, and most of the heavy resources seem to be going into Navy and Air Force. I guess the Army has a personnel problem attracting sufficient people, but have you got an observation?
Yeah, there's always a big tussle between all the various forces, of course, the Air Force, the Navy and the Army. The argument to increase the Army's strength is pretty strong, because they're the ones who actually tend to do the heavy lifting these days. They're the ones that go over there on peacekeeping missions and things. It used to be very unfashionable. The Army, after Vietnam, was very unfashionable, and they built up the Air Force and the Navy and thought, you know, the rest of the world can go jump, we're just going to defend Australia. And that was the primary basis upon which the Defence Force is still structured. But now the you know, successive governments have realised you've actually got to get a bigger army, because they're the ones who actually go over on these peacekeeping missions. So you know, it's progressively we're seeing a change where the army is getting bigger. But I agree with you. The trouble is the SAS is too small, and in places like Afghanistan, they're the ones that do the fighting, and they're exhausted now. They've done rotation after rotation. I mean, those poor blokes are absolutely stuffed.
Oh, no.
I want to start off with. In support of print media, I've just renewed my subscription to The Australian.
Yes.
Because I think it's important. Two things. One is shipbuilding. DSTO study indicated that 15 years was about the optimum cycle for a ship, and that beyond that, you have a law of diminishing returns, and yet maintenance budgets are far larger than building budgets. But on a 15-year cycle, we could actually project a consistent shipbuilding program, much like the European countries do. The British put a hull in the water every year. The Americans used to put about six hulls in the water every year. And as you highlighted, we tend not to do that. So although we buy a Spanish blueprint, the air warfare destroyer is behind budget, the far more complex project, which was the amphibious assault ships, is actually ahead of schedule, under budget, and on time for the Spanish shipyards. So do we need to get the political will to have a consistent building program in order to sustain this home building?
That's an excellent... Sorry.
So that's the first question. The second one is, I take exception to this increasing of the SASR. It consumes too much resources as it is.
Sorry, the what?
The Special Air Service. There are times where the Army stopped training for 2 years in order to feed the SASR. I would argue that the point is... the SASR is overused. We're using Special Forces troops for kinetic missions, whereas really the principal role is deep reconnaissance. And the political will is not there to engage the Army. I would say the Army's not there for peacekeeping. The Army's there to fight, but not there.
I think the government's frightened to put regular troops in situations that they think they may founder. And I think that's what's behind the SAS being... When I say the SAS, in my opinion, is used too much, I don't disagree with what you're saying there. I think that you could use a lot more regular troops, but they're not doing it. Perhaps it's partly the nature of the mission in Afghanistan as well. But I think really, you know, you're right, they could use a lot more regular troops. And your comment on the ships is actually really... true. If the government's going to be serious about this stuff, that's exactly the way I think to do it. The way is you literally say, okay, we're going to need X amount of frigates over 50 years, I mean 60 years, a century even really, and then X amount of these and X amount of these. And so you build the shipyards and you have them spitting out these ships every 3-5 years, whatever you require, and you have that even sort of flow. That's a long-term strategic planning thing that no Australian government has ever taken on. It's certainly been discussed, I know that, but I don't know. In this current political environment, I don't see such long-term planning, but I think that's an issue and an idea which needs a lot more discussion and has a lot of merit in theory.
Question. Thank you, Joshua. It's very interesting. We're focusing quite a lot on conventional warfare. The white paper was primarily talking about the conventional armed forces. And while it was specifically mentioning threats from China, I believe the Chinese took quite a lot of ire when the actual white paper was published because they saw a veiled threat there. The question is, while Australia may not face a military threat right now, the threat that we are facing is more of an intelligence threat from foreign intelligence organisations attempting to steal either research data, attempting to infiltrate Australian communications, intelligence, large industries. What approach has been taken by Australia to actually prevent that? What is a counterintelligence?
With the Chinese, for example, I mean, it's a delicate subject in government circles, of course, but The Chinese are very aggressive in cyber warfare with Australia. They regularly try to hack into Australia's defence networks and security networks, diplomatic networks as well, as they do in most other Western countries. And I think the Australian government's been very, very slow and in responding to this. And it has been, it's only now really trying to catch up. We've gone to the Americans and we've asked them for help because they're far more advanced than we are on these issues. And there is a very, very big battle going on, a very secret battle at the moment, to try and get Australia's counter-cyber capability up to speed. But, I mean, there is a lot. The defence area is a very, very heavily contested one, and it's one we don't see much of. But you're right, there's a lot going on. Wish I knew more about it.
I want to ask you a fundamental question. See, I think this China is enormous. It's got an enormous population, an enormous army, navy, and air force with immense capability. We are nothing. Now, China is in many ways dependent on us. A question, perhaps. Now, I think the idea of relying, we want to be severing our relationship with the Americans. The Yankee, I think, is unreliable and is bankrupt. And I don't think that is really understood properly in Australia. So, I think also the idea of having Americans in the top of Australia is dangerously provocative, because the Chinese buy a lot of our iron ore. And having Americans' troops with the associated listening devices, everything that comes with the Yankee, is clearly going to be provocative, or seemed to be provocative by the Chinese. I think it would be better if we invited the Chinese to come up. You tell me what's wrong with that. What is the threat posed by China? We hear this all the time. China, the threat from China. But what is the threat? They take our iron ore, they supply all our shirts and socks and underwear. We're almost integrated with them. So where's the threat? Are they going to come and invade us? And indeed, even if they could, if they landed a task force, for example, 5,000-6,000 troops with associated artillery, armour, and helicopter and smog, what could we do about it? We couldn't do anything. The only thing that would stop them would be the traffic on Sydney Harbour Bridge when they got there. You see the point I'm making?
Thank you very much. I think we do.
I think that there's nothing wrong with being provocative as far as American troops go. I think that Australia, we play a double game with China. We massive trading partner, very important. We certainly pursue that aggressively. And while rhetorically we don't choose sides with China and America, we say, that we're our own country. I think there's no doubt the Chinese aren't naive. I mean, they know that we are totally invested with America. I mean, putting American troops in bases in northern Australia, when I say putting them, I'm just saying letting them coexist there while they go on missions and things like that, on operations and things. I think that that is something which wouldn't change the parameter at all. I mean, if Australia happened to be at war with China for some horrific degree, I mean, we'd be a target immediately with Pine Gap. We'd be a natural target, and that wouldn't particularly change anything. As far as, Americans being here or Chinese being here, well, that's, I think really it's, the Americans are our strongest alliance, and I don't think there's any doubt where Australia's sympathies would be.
Young lady, isn't it?
I just wanted to ask a question about our strategic defensive relationships, again with the US. And I'm wondering if you can comment on the extent to which interoperability requirements are impacting our purchasing decisions and in our wider strategic decision making.
They are. I think they should be more, considered more. I mean, Australia has a habit of getting stuff that can't necessarily be shared too easily. And that's another reason, I think, why you're better off buying a lot of off-the-shelf stuff, because if you buy them from the Americans, mind you, are very tardy about giving out stealthy codes. They're not. They're funny because you're a close ally, but they actually balk at giving you high classification codes, which can make it a little bit hard to be as interoperable as you might want. For example, the Joint Strike Fighter, Australia was the very first country in the world that signed up to this paper plane, you know, and yet the Americans were very, very reluctant to promise all the sort of codes and things that you particularly need for it. So I think that's a bit of an issue. But Australia needs to be, it's just a case of you haven't got that many dollars. You just have to make each dollar count. And I think being interoperable is strategically sensible and financially sensible. And it's just the way to go.
Doctor.
Following on from the question from the gentleman 2 questions ago, I guess I feel like I'm somewhat naive about the rest of the world's view of Australia being so hand-in-hand with the US. And I find it quite concerning to think that rational thinking isn't in play at the moment about their financial crisis. And we're only 16 months off from there being a new commander-in-chief, potentially. I never thought there'd be anyone worse than Bush, but I think probably November of next year there will be. And I just sort of wonder how you can rationally say to us that having American forces on Australian soil, led by a commander-in-chief with as much sense as the current Republicans, is going to be a wise move for Australia.
Well, I mean, certainly we don't always agree with what the Americans do in their foreign policy, but I think there's a very consistent theme throughout history of being, you know, very much side by side with most of the things they do. And I don't always agree with some of their issues. I don't particularly agree with Iraq or Afghanistan, the extent of Australia's involvement in those countries under those circumstances. But I don't think that letting the Americans use Australian facilities in northern Australia would change that. I don't think it forces us to be lockstep with the Americans. And with the Americans, you know, they have a very eccentric political culture. But they're, you know, that what doesn't change is they've got easily the biggest military by many fold, and we're one of the very closest allies. And you know, they can't hurt for Australia, you wouldn't think. Oh, I think they would, regardless of any basing in northern Australia. I've always thought that. And I think Australia plays that card far too much, the concept that, oh, we must go on this expedition because otherwise they won't come. And I mean, it's in America's interest to come and defend a country like Australia. I just think it's vastly overblown.
Why?
Pardon?
Why?
Because you wouldn't want this to be a springboard to hurt their interests in the Pacific.
Yes, gentlemen.
Hi. In the life of an Australian military build-up, at what point would Australia be defensible against a threat like China, forgetting America in the background?
I don't think it is defensible, really. At the moment it would be, because the Chinese couldn't really project that much force over here. But there's a point at which it wouldn't be. You'd need the Americans, I think, in any sort of serious engagement. And that's one of the things which has been a bit of a sort of dream world in Canberra, to some degree. Defence planners try and build, like, the defence white paper, very much built with the concept of somehow Australia might actually find itself independently in a conflict with China. I mean, that's just not going to happen. I don't think there's any circumstances under which that would happen.
Yeah, I just wonder how intelligent it is to spend so much money on something that might just be a show of force in the end.
Good point.
Right at the back.
I wanted to ask, why is there so little North Asian security news published in Australia, and what are some of the issues behind it? For example, the Fatima base issue in Japan, it looks like it's not going to get resolved. Territorial disputes, Japan and China, and North Korean missiles being shot over Japan constantly. Why did we get that sort of view?
I'll tell our Tokyo and Beijing correspondents to work harder. we've got them up there. Look, I mean, every news is taken, you know, on its values. I think there's a... I don't really agree with that. I think that we had a lot of stuff about the Fukushima power plants. I mean, it was... You know, enormous news at the time, and now it has dropped off a bit, I agree, but I mean, we hear about the North Korean missiles and things. I don't really agree that we don't hear enough of it, but I'm interested in that perspective.
Yes, yeah.
Thanks, Karen. What I've found interesting in the last 12 months of my travels around Asia is that I suppose on the theme of what the gentleman just raised then was the Chinese National Oil Company, CNOOC, has negotiated berthing rights in most of the new nations to our north, Papua New Guinea, Dili, the Solomon Islands, Fiji, and we've just totally lost sight of that. And also the fact that we're looking at the fact from defending ourselves, but in natural fact, what they're defending is resource security. And having lived and worked in Asia, predominantly Indonesia in the last 5 years, that has really come to the fore in the fact that the Spratly Islands being under constant threat from the Chinese expansionism, because primarily it's a protected resource, yet don't read that much about that. There's no joining of the dots in the fact that CINOC has gone literally around the world and purchased up all the little gas fields and oil fields that American production companies don't want because it's not financially viable for them to operate, yet as a national oil company, they can afford that hit. So they've purchased, and all of a sudden, they've developed a capability. Yet we don't have visual on that.
No, the government does. We don't see it much of it in the media, but there's enormous, in the Pacific Ocean at the moment, strangely enough, there's an enormous battle going on between government and Australia as far as recognition of favours to Pacific Islands and Southeast Asia to a degree as well. But, I mean, the Chinese are always trying to put up embassies in Nauru and places, diplomatic representation to the smallest places. They can set up an embassy, set up a listening station, have influence. And through foreign aid, the Chinese are very proactive. And there's in East Timor, I think I read recently, there was quite a big thing they tried to do with down at the port in East Timor. You know, Australia is well aware of that, but there's only limited ways you can try to combat this stuff. I mean, they're just very Chinese, very rightly and justifiably, they're allowed to extend their influence in any way they want, and that's what they're trying to do.
Zara Kimpton. Over the past 15 years, Australian armed forces have been involved in East Timor, Iraq and Afghanistan now. How much do you think that has helped increase the abilities and efficiencies of our armed forces, because they've actually been involved in conflict? And as we move forward, if we leave Afghanistan in 2014, and perhaps there are no other conflicts, which of course is what we hope, but if you join the army, the navy, and there's no battles to fight, how well trained can you be from just doing exercises in Australia and maybe joint exercises with other countries? And also, would you want to be a member of the armed forces if there's nothing happening?
Yeah, I would. rather than when something is happening. But look, I mean, that's true. I think it's enormously beneficial for the actual troops and for the systems to have to have the Iraq, Afghanistan and Timor especially, because even though it's not a hot war in any way, the rotations and the long-term presence there, Solomon Islands as well, I think it's really helpful that that happened. But, I mean, in the end, you don't want those things to happen just to keep your forces well-trained. I think that they would go off the boil a bit if there weren't any particular conflicts. And it's interesting because we're now getting to the point where the troops will be coming out of Afghanistan 2014 at the latest, I think, maybe a little bit earlier, who knows. But then Timor's winding up. How long are they going to be in the Solomons? I mean, we're actually in a position now, unless we see a new conflict, a major conflict around the world, you're going to be in the position you're talking about in a couple of years, which would be a really interesting position for Australia to be in. Possibly, like we sent 1,000 troops to Somalia in the early 90s. I mean, that was a radical move, a long way away, the first deployment of that size since Vietnam. So maybe we'd do that, but I think we'd be looking to have a bit of a rest for a while, personally.
Yeah. If China was aggressive to us, how would Singapore stand up? Would they be our ally, or would they be Chinese?
I think that most of Southeast Asia would be incredibly desperate to appear neutral for as long as possible. I would suggest that if push came to shove, the Singaporeans would be in the American camp.
Because Singapore normally is an ally of us, isn't it, or considered reliable?
But the Southeast Asia is having a really interesting response to China. It's really China's military expenditure is really spooking some countries in Southeast Asia. They're very wary of it. A lot more, yeah.
I'm looking for people who haven't asked a question. This one here, this will be the last.
Alex Oye from RMIT. Just regarding your perceptions of perhaps the mood in Canberra regarding cyber threats, I mean, there seems in my own research to be this idea that you can just build a new building and fill it with computers and give it a secret classification and the problem will go away, whereas the kind of cascading threats from cyber attacks all affect industry, affects commerce, banking and society. Is there like a lack of awareness? I mean, how is this actually perceived people in Canberra? It doesn't seem to really be taken seriously.
Oh, no, they're taking it seriously, but as I said before, I think they're taking it seriously in a belated way. And I actually wonder, I mean, I wonder whether, you know, they should be getting a bunch of guys like you, you know, your age, to actually understand these things a lot more than some of their older analysts, I think, who are a bit left behind on the cyber warfare side. So I'm kind of curious. I'd love to get let into one of those buildings and have a look around and see what sort of people actually work in them. You know, but it's I mean, when my previous employer DSD is involved in that issue, I mean, this is 20 years ago now, and it was incredibly secret and strange then. And so I can't even imagine how secret and locked up this debate is in Canberra. But I'd be fascinated to know. Let me know if you hear anything.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Cameron, you've dispelled a few myths tonight, and I hope we've dispelled another myth, one about the Institute of International Affairs here in Victoria, that we're a right-wing organisation. I think you can gather from some of the questions today that or tonight that we're not notoriously right-wing. We look to all aspects of questions regarding international relations. I think we've been very lucky to have Cameron here tonight. He's dealt with a whole range of issues, all of them fascinating. Release a new model white paper. Now there's an ask, because it's not too long since the last one. But I agree with you. I think we do. I think we do need a new. I was fascinated with some of the things. I like the statement that there is a malaise affecting Australia's security. I think that's pretty right. And one of the malaises affecting Australian security, in my view, is the understanding of the general public about the security situation in which we are established. And speaking as a former poly, one of the things that was very, very difficult to sustain over a long period of time when you were talking about expenditure for defence were people asking, well, what about all the schools that we have and all the hospitals? Where's the threat? And we don't have that seriously explained by anybody at the present time. If we're advocating the expenditure of vast amounts of money, which lots of people are, and I don't disagree with it, but I do think that we need to have amongst the general populace a better understanding of the security situation that we do face and that we are part of. So all in all, I found it a really interesting and challenging debate. One of the questions was, you didn't say much about the army. Now, I'm a trained fighting machine. May not look like it to you, but I was a 77-day wonder doing national service in the 1950s. Trained fighting machine in the infantry. Never forget, the men who hold the ground are the infantry. So you can have all the airplanes around the place in the naval. Well, that was the start. But we were very dangerous people with a Bren gun or an Owen gun, I tell you. And so I'm a great supporter of the infantry, and unfortunately I don't think they get enough understanding and support at the present time. But all the other services would say exactly the same thing. There's lots of things I would like to ask you and suggest. When I first went into the Parliament, there was a Defence Minister, there was an Army Minister, there was a Navy Minister, and there was an Air Force Minister. We don't have those now. And it may be that we should look in the future at having a similar sort of organisation so we can get the political scrutiny over a broad range of things, but more directed at the individual services than is currently the case. So, ladies and gentlemen, would you join with me in thanking Cameron very much indeed for a most important... Something to do. No, I wish it was. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, it being 7 o'clock, that closes the evening. Thank you for your attendance. The meeting is ended.